Good evening. Glad to see you here once again. I'm Jack Hopke. This week's compendium of Southeast Louisiana articles begins with a troubling reminder. Back in December of 2010, 8 young people died in a New Orleans warehouse fire. Local accounts described them as homeless squatters. Recently, Talk of the Nation's Neil Conan hosted a roundtable to discuss the people involved in the unfortunate events. He was joined by the author of a recent article discussing the subculture. That was journalist Danelle Morton. But first, he spoke with Marty Gosley Jaramillo, the mother of a 21-year-old girl who died in the fire.
Where did you think Katie was?
Well, I knew she was in New Orleans, and I knew she was traveling. She had set out on an adventure, and she was in Portland, and she had gone down to Northern California with a set of friends, is what she said, and that is indeed what she did. And she was traveling around and just seeing the sights, you know, just wanted to get out there and have adventures and see the world.
She didn't tell you, though, she was riding the rails.
Well, at that point, she wasn't. And, you know, I have received her journal since her death, and that confirms that. And I don't think she had done that until maybe she got to San Diego or Arizona. But, no, she never did reveal to me that she was hopping trains from time to time.
And how much about her life did she tell you?
Well, she told me quite a lot. A lot of her talk was mostly in philosophies, you know, and things that I have learned from her journal that I got after she passed.
One of the things I gather confused you a bit is she told you that she'd learned how to cook over an open fire down there in New Orleans.
Exactly, yeah. And I would ask her, well, Katie, why would you have to cook over an open fire? And why would you have to learn how to make coffee over an open fire? I wasn't clear on that, and any time I would question her, she would, you know, become sharp and say, Mother, I don't have time for these questions. I only have a short time on this phone.
and the other thing was you kept hearing trains in the background.
Yes, exactly. I was like, why do the trains, I mean, you sound like you're on a train. We're really close to the tracks. And of course, after seeing all the videos from the fire and whatnot, I noticed that they were definitely right next to the tracks.
For greater access, I guess. And
yes.
The warehouse was a convenient place to live. And a bunch of kids, not just your daughter, were living there. And she was really, I guess, part of a community, but a transient group of people who connected and reconnected and knew each other, sort of. But what did you learn about this kind of life from her writings?
Well, if you would allow me to, I could read a short excerpt from her journal.
Sure.
Okay. Well, it starts off, it only takes about a minute or so. It says, time has flown by so fast, it's easy to get swept up in the lack of normal responsibility. In the last week, we stayed in an amazing squat, so much good food and living room picnics, 7 of us at one point, as well as a dog named Hamburgers. We were on the 5th floor of a very nice apartment complex, making it easy to keep our filth and debauchery hidden from our society and police. The fancy apartments across the way could see straight in, and I wondered what they must have thought of us. Maybe some envied us, some disgusted. I'm not sure. I know I felt a little sorry for them. Most of them must have been trapped in work and bills. They are the kind of people that take 20 pills a day and ignore their kids. I wanted to tell them they don't have to live that way, but who was I to say what they should do? Maybe they were happy that way. That was just a little excerpt from, you know, what she was thinking at the time, which I always found was kind of ironic because, you know, that's just how other people look at other people.
Sure. She mentioned her own the depravity and filth that she lived in, and I think to some degree ironic, but I think there's some truth to that, too.
Yeah.
Do you think she was happy?
Oh, I know she was, and I can remember one of the last conversations I had with her, and she said, you know, Mom, please don't, you know, what did she say? Don't frown on my lifestyle, please. if you did, I just don't know what I would do. And I said, well, Katie, as long as you're happy, that's all I care about. And she's like, I am happy. I'm happier than I've ever been.
Marty. So
what's a parent to do?
Well, worry, I suspect.
I suspect, yes.
Yeah, well, I think that,
you know, her motto that she always stuck true to was, I promise myself to never stop living life in its adventure. I want to wake up every morning with a smile on my face and go to bed every night exhausted. And I know she lived her life completely that way. And everyone that came in contact with her remembered her beautiful smile and her bright spirit, and it lives on to inspire all of us to live our life to the fullest and to love your family and to accept them for who they are and just be grateful for each and every day.
Marty Gosley, Jaramillo, thanks very much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you for sharing the story.
Katie Seminar's story came to our attention through journalist Danelle Morton. Her daughter was part of this tribe and agreed to be her mom's guide to allow her to tell the story of the people who died in that New Orleans warehouse fire. She published her article in the Boston Review, and Danelle Morton joins us now from member station KQED in San Francisco, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you.
And I have to ask you, I'm sure you talked to your daughter. Was she happy when she was a transient?
I think most of the time she was happy. I think she was happy to be completely free. I know there were many an evening when it was uncomfortable for her and where she wondered where she was going to get her next meal. But as they always say, as many of them said in New Orleans, you're looking for your survival and you're doing it with your friends. So every day has this kind of intensity that you can't get in the regular world.
And intensity that blossoms friendships much more quickly than you could find in the quote-unquote real world.
Almost like being a war correspondent where there's danger all around and you form a very tight bond with the people that you can depend on.
War correspondents know what they're getting in for. Do you think all these transients do?
I do. I think, you know, there's a difference between being part of this group and being just a homeless teenager who lives on the street. This has a society, it has a community, it has a structure to it. It's almost like a tribe. And when the kids travel across country, they do so in groups of maybe three or five or six sometimes. And when they roll into town, they always, one of them knows like the bar or the cafe where you can go and hang out and find a warm couch to sleep on or a place to throw down your sleeping bag, because you're all connected in this kind of underground world.
After the fire, the local papers described those who were killed as homeless, as runaways. And you talked to people afterwards when you went back with your daughter to find out who they were, that others of this tribe resented that. They said, no, we're artists, we're musicians.
Well, and many of them are, but I think mainly they were concerned about the notion that people were dismissing them as just sort of drunken, tattooed bums, when in fact this is an affirmative choice. It isn't something they fall into because they make a mistake. They actually say, I want to live this way. This is this life has its own, I don't think many people from our world would say values, but it does have its own sense of structure and value.
There seem to be a lot of drinking and tattoos, though.
Well, yes. I think they go together.
And other drugs as well. I mean, it's one of the kids you wrote about was, in fact, someone who was prescribed medication, and his friends cheered when he stopped taking it.
Right. And you're talking about Jonathan Guerrero. He was diagnosed as bipolar and he was taking lithium. And, you know, when kids start to flirt with this lifestyle, their parents become very concerned. And many of them take their children to therapists and the therapists put them on antidepressants. So a signature act of rebellion when you leave home to embrace this life is to say, I'm not taking those drugs, because they just dull you. They make you unable to experience the world around you. And I'm just going to break free of all of that. But illegal drugs and alcohol are very commonplace.
And people self-medicate. And sometimes those prescription drugs are necessary. I mean,
Well, we think lithium for bipolar is pretty necessary.
Yeah. So there is also, as you said, an element of real danger in this. You kept worrying all the time your daughter was gone that she would die in a fire in a squat.
Well, not just a fire in the squad, although that was one of the major things I worried about. The train yards themselves are very dangerous. There's about 500 trespasser fatalities in the rail yards every year. They tend to cluster in the ruined parts of the country. In New Orleans, there's 42,000 abandoned houses. They live in these abandoned houses in the worst crime area of New Orleans. So it isn't just the danger of the squat, but it's also the crime and the railroad mistakes that can be made because you're drunk on a train. So there were many, many ways that one of this crowd can end their lives.
But that danger, you say, is also part of the attraction.
Well, I don't know if danger, yeah, danger is part of the attraction, but it's also this kind of radical freedom where they're not responsible to anyone. Their money is not important. They live for free in squats and they get their food out of dumpsters and they have no need of money. There was one young woman that I interviewed in a squat who pointed to $3 that were sitting on a crate next to her mattress and said that $3 had been on that crate for 3 days. She had no need for money.
Need for a clinic from time to time, though.
Well, there's, you know, it's an unclean world, and it isn't easy to get a bath if you're living in a squat with no water. So very virulent infections like MRSA are common, and so there are frequent emergency room visits.
That's some Talk of the Nation, a program heard weekdays at 1 p.m. on WWNO2. And this is WWNO's All Things New Orleans. You can hear our features anytime at our website, WWNO.org. I'm Jack Hopke with you for our February 9th edition. 200 Years of Art in Louisiana. I beg your pardon. The latest edition, let's tell you about this first. The latest edition of Louisiana Cultural Vistas profiles a new book and a digital platform that are focused on that subject, 200 Years of Art in Louisiana. And WWNO's Paul Mawson recently spoke with the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, Michael Sartiski, about the project.
We are very excited about this prospect, Paul. As you and many of your listeners undoubtedly know, April 30th, 2012, is the bicentennial of Louisiana statehood. And the Louisiana State Bicentennial Commission, chaired by General Russell Honoré, has commissioned the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities to do what we're calling the Bicentennial Book Project. Officially, it's called A Unique Slant of Light, The Bicentennial History of Art in Louisiana. We have about 16 images of artists ranging from the early 19th century up to the contemporary moment to illustrate the remarkable and wonderful range of art that has been produced in this state.
Covering a wide range of topics, how was the selection process for this?
This book is only possible because of the collections and archives of major institutions as well as private collectors, the Historic New Orleans Collection, the Louisiana State Museum's collection of paintings, the Roger Ogden Museum of Southern Art, and Roger Ogden's own personal collection, about half of which is not yet in the museum. Arthur Rogers Gallery has been invaluable in giving us access to their digital collection of artists' work. So it's a compendium of literally thousands and thousands of works of art. But here's the interesting thing, Paul. The project exists on three levels. It's going to be a beautiful, oversized coffee table hardcover book. It's a commemorative volume. That book is then going to be digitized, not downloadable, but digitized on the web. And if you were to click, for example, on any single artist, such as Jacques Amont, if you click on their image in the digital version of the book, it will take you through a link to our Know Louisiana, or NOLA, Digital Encyclopedia of Louisiana, where there will be a longer biographical entry on the artist, and not just the one painting, but an image gallery of as many as a dozen or two dozen. So we have the print world and the digital world with this project, and at the same time creating what will be a permanent resource and the single major go-to place for any information that you want about art or photography in the history of Louisiana.
So not only looking at the pieces, a book, but also the accessibility to see more online. It's a pretty big project.
It's monumental. And I can't overemphasize the generosity and the collaboration of all of these partner agencies. There are also far more than I can name today on the program, not just dozens, but scores of scholars and other writers who have contributed. Many of the individual artists have assisted us in this project. And it's not just New Orleans. The Norton Gallery of Art, which not a lot of people down here have heard of, it's up in Shreveport, has really an extremely interesting collection. One painter in particular will be featuring in the book, Felix Kelly, who does these absolutely unique phantasmagorical renderings of steamboats and plantations, but in a style that's unmistakably just his.
And remember, you heard phantasmagorical first here.
It is public radio after all.
You heard Michael Sartiski speaking with our Paul Mawson about A Unique Slant of Light, The Bicentennial History of Art in Louisiana. More information about the book can be found in the latest edition of Louisiana Cultural Vistas or online at leh.org. I'm Jack Hopke with all things New Orleans for you on this Thursday evening. We'll be followed by Fresh Air at 7 o'clock tonight. On this week's edition of Notes from New Orleans, Sharon Litwin discusses the humble beginnings of an accomplished architect.
Like so many folk in New Orleans, I drive that stretch of I-10 coming into the CBD on a regular basis, always passing by the Xavier University campus. Over the past many months, I have happily watched new building after new building going up, intrigued by the continuation of green as the color on all the roofs, a trend started by architect Ron Blitch some years back.
Ron has done many buildings on campus. We did the library and pharmacy expansion as a joint venture, and that did establish the Xavier roof color, which has been used throughout the campus.
That's architect Ray Manning, whose firm, along with others, is responsible for many of those buildings. In the summer of 2005, Ray and the Xavier administration had just completed a master plan that was to assist the university in raising its student body from the then slightly more than 4,000 students to a new high of 6,000.
The storm happened. Xavier had anywhere between 6 to 8 feet of water in some locations. And thus began a whole series of events, which was key to, I think, their long-term survival. I think they did it as well as any other university in the city.
But Xavier is not the only large-scale plan Ray is or has been involved with. Beginning with the 1984 World's Fair, moving forward to the Aquarium of the Americas, New Orleans Arena, and Waldenburg Park. So how did a guy who grew up in modest circumstances in Franklinton, Louisiana, end up an architect?
My father, Arthur Manning, was a gentleman who had very limited education. I think my father didn't finish sixth grade. But my father was a person who knew the building trades and at some point cobbled together some funds to start a building business, very small scale. And he had a primary job, his full-time job, and he would work in the evenings and on the weekends on building what at the time was a HUD 236 housing program. And through the FHA in rural areas, this was a way for individuals to own a home. I would always remember that the plans for the homes would come in the mail, and they'd be in a tube, and after dinner, I would see him poring over these plans as he started to do an estimate for the cost of these homes. And And then he had three sons, and we became the crew, so to speak, the working crew on those houses. Other individuals, obviously, but we never lacked for after-school work because there was always a house going up. And so we did carpentry. We put in a lot of bat insulation in these homes and did roof work in the middle of the summer. And as it turned out, I got very comfortable with that process.
Which, after graduating Washington Parish High School, led Ray first to a Bachelor of Architecture from Southern University, then to a Master of Architecture from the University of Michigan, and on to continuing education in design and management at both Harvard and Dartmouth universities.
Seeing my father, who, again, as I look at him from this distance now, I realize how incredibly smart he was. Because, again, imagine someone without a high school education, without a college degree, who could read architectural plans, who could go out, stake a house out. These are not elaborate structures, but the fact that he could do that. And that's how it got started for me.
Now, after 25 years in business, Ray is pretty positive about post-Katrina New Orleans.
Architecturally, I think we're in a very good place because we now, I think, have a city administration and the support from the federal government where we've been able to take advantage of what was obviously a tragic event of 2005, 80% of the city flooded, emptying the city out. 100,000+ of our citizens haven't returned to the city. The silver lining is all of the work that has been done in the city through the federal sources of funds, the levee system, some of the outflow canals being rebuilt. So I think there's a sense, and I certainly share this as part of my new role in the Sewage and Water Board, that we are in better shape than we were before 2005.
For more information about what's going on architecturally in the city, go to wwno.org or nolavie.com. For WWNO, I'm Sharon Lippman.
Sharon Litwin is the former executive director of the LPO and the co-founder of NOLAVIE. Time to wrap up all things New Orleans for this day, February 9th. But remember, you can hear our features anytime at WWNO.org. I'm Jack Hopke right here in the studio, working as always with our behind-the-scenes pals, executive producer Paul Mawson and producer-editor Thomas Walsh. Send us your comments and suggestions at info@WWNO.org. We'll see you next Thursday. Happy Carnival.